Raymond, we were talking about how the death experience is being shared now by a loved one, by a doctor, by a nurse, that they just seem to be able to share this. How does this happen?
Well, George, if you've got the answer to that one, let me know right away.
Really?
But I tell you, this is something, George, that's going to really totally change the debate, because it's in this kind of society, it's superficially plausible to say about the near-death experiences when somebody almost dies and their oxygen gets cut off to the brain and so on. There's a surface plausibility in saying that the experience was caused by the diminished oxygen flow creating a hallucination or whatever. But if the same phenomenon is reported in every detail, George, by the people standing around whose impression is or feeling is that they partially accompany their dying loved one to the other side. For example, I have many cases of people saying that when a loved one died in the bed, that the bystanders themselves feel like they get out of their body, they go part way toward this light with the dying loved one. People will tell me that as their loved one dies, the room fills up with this extraordinary light that permeates everything. As you mentioned earlier, a common thing I hear is that people say in some indescribable way that the whole geometry of the room changed, rather than finding themselves in the cubicle shape or the rectangular solid shape of a hospital room. The room seemed to distort in its shape and often seems to form up into a sort of hourglass shape. People will say that they hear heavenly music that seems to be coming from nowhere. I hear lots of cases in which people say that as their loved one dies, they perceive the spirits of the deceased relatives and friends of the person who's dying seem to come to meet the person who's just died. And most incredibly of all to me, George, this is one that just really is astonishing, but I have a number of cases in which some person standing by empathically co-lives the panoramic life review of the person who's dead.
That's phenomenal.
Now, what is going on here? You've known me for a long time, and you've known that I'm just very reluctant to draw the conclusion that there's an afterlife, since it was not in my background. It's a very difficult thing for me to put together for myself, and yet...
Well, that's what makes you so credible.
But now, you know, I've really gotten into the point where I'm sort of feeling boxed into a corner in the sense that...
You're tipping, aren't you?
In the sense, George, that now, I mean, I try to pay close attention to what's going on inside of me, and now it's beginning to seem that when I try to say some other thing other than just what seems to be, namely that there does seem to be a state of existence after death, I feel inside like I'm running away from something or trying to rationalize rather than just to face what seems to be. So it really has tipped me over, along with some other stuff. I mean, there's a big background on this, but... basically, I think it's going to be very hard now to argue this case against this being connected somehow with an afterlife, because one of the signs of a weak argument, as you know, is from your interviewing experience, and which I know as a professor of logic and critical thinking, You know, when somebody has a weak case, one sign of it is they shift their grounds on you. Mm-hmm. Now, if you take the position of a hypothetical scoffer, let's say, who looks at all this, and when they're confronted with the stories of the near-death experience, somebody who almost dies and returns, they say, oh, well, obviously that's the cut off of the oxygen flow to the brain. But then you say, well, what about the bystanders who have the same experience and yet they're not ill or injured? There's nothing wrong with their brain.
Good point.
Then they shift to a psychological explanation and they say, oh, they're just hysterical or emotional or wishful thinking or whatever. Well, that's not fair. That's a sign that somebody's case is weak. You see, like to shift grounds like that. So it's got to be, you know, it's like to, it's not fair to make that kind of move. And so it's really pushing me toward saying, in effect, well, if it's not life after death, what is this? I mean, this is something really, really important that we need to take a look at.
And maybe we go back, Raymond, to where we began, you know, in this hall of souls just waiting to be born, and then here we are, and it goes back again. I don't know.
Well, you know, that's certainly what Plato said in this, in many of his works, but he talks about that in The Republic, this warrior who was believed dead on the battlefield but revived talks about that very thing, about seeing people sort of lined up to be born. And this is a really exciting development, I think, because one thing, you know, George, how conservative I am in inferences, but one thing I feel completely confident in saying is that in another 5 years' time, the whole debate about life after death, and I'm talking here about the rational debate, is going to look an entirely different way. I mean, there's things coming here that are just going to be very, very difficult to talk your way out of. It's beginning to look like to me within the next few years we're going to have, and I mean genuine, solid progress toward rational comprehension of this mystery of an afterlife.
All right. Now, let's bring in Dr. John Turner. John, let's react to some of this based on the things you've heard Raymond talk about.
Well, first of all, I have some interesting comments on that. This altered geometry. You know, George, a year and a half ago when we talked, it was March 24th, and my small book had just come out, and I've learned so much since the publication of that book, George. The main thing I've learned is forgiveness, true forgiveness. Mm-hmm. But I've learned a lot of technical things. And I can say now that, you know, I used to think the brain produced consciousness. And all through my training, medical school and then neurosurgery, and then in the years of practice, I would have always answered that question that way. The brain produces all that we know. But now I've changed, George. I've learned through many people who have studied this all their lives and all the study I've done that consciousness produces the brain. So I think we have to look at the brain much as we look at a radio receiver. And the fact that a radio produces the music doesn't mean that it generates the music. It simply interprets it. So since everything that we look at or we see now, George, as we look around, and Raymond, we're looking at our room here and whatever, is all a manifestation of energy. You'd have to agree with that. And the brain kind of keeps this in the form that it needs to be. It acts as a governor so we can go through these experiences we're here to do. But we're all in a field of consciousness. This whole thing is consciousness. And then it gets complicated with the parallel universes and all that. But I think this wavering of geometry has to do with the brain, you know, losing some of that filtering effect to allow those things to happen. I think this bird's eye view when people leave their body has to do a lot with the fact that this is the way sometimes we see things in memory. We see it as a bird's eye view or a first person view.